So after talking to Wee Ching and when I was leaving Ethiopia and coming back, one of the things we agreed on is we're going to wait till he's back where we can have a concentrated time to share all the stories, because there's going to be aid that is going to be continued to give throughout the church. And he and another church member from here at Peace, who's also over there, who met us over there, they're still distributing aid to the church. So he and I, we're planning to have a Bible class hour probably in a month when he's back, and we'll share all those stories. But I did want to share a few videos with you at least, just so you can kind of see where we came from and what we were dealing with. First off, Wee Ching's wife and his son, who's 1 year old, they met us at the hotel. And one day when we were there, I told the two of them, hey, go get something to eat. I'll stay here with the baby, which seemed to make them uncomfortable. But and Wee Ching's got this funny thing where he thinks babies just, like, they talk nonsense. He kept telling me, they just talk nonsense. And I'm like, no, you can talk to a baby even when you don't speak the same language. Let me give you an example. This is Birdit and I. We're Say there hi. At the table.
Say hi.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Oh.
Are you hungry?
Yeah.
What do you want?
Little.
Can you say papa? Can you say papa?
Yes. See, he understands me just fine. There's no problem at all.
Yeah.
This next picture I want to show you is a picture of a van. And this is significant because you don't see a lot of cars over there. There are taxis everywhere, and most of the taxis in Ethiopia are essentially motorcycles with this buggy on the back of it. And the buggy, from most American appearances, would hold two small humans. But according to Africans, you're supposed to jam like five people into the back of them. And at one point, the African pastors that are there with me, and I'm in this buggy, and they get others to help shove people and then stick another one in there, which is enjoyable. Never. It's never enjoyable. But when it was time for us to go to Gambela, and we had to take a flight from Addis Ababa to Gambela, and then from the town of Gambela, we had to take a van for about a couple hours, and then we had to cross into the village of Jakku, which is right on the border of South Sudan. And there's a village of Jakku here, and then on the other side in South Sudan, there's another village of Jakku. When Wee Ching was growing up, they would go back and forth with their animals for grazing. So he used to live in both of these villages. But now his people, his brother, his cousins, his mom before she passed away, they live in this village in Jakku, right there in Ethiopia. And to get to the village on foot, number one, I got to watch one of the women take a full-size suitcase and stick it up on top of her head and refuse to let any of the men carry it. And the Ethiopian pastors, Sudanese pastors, they kept telling me, no, 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 that's what women do. And I'm thinking, that would be nice, but I don't even know that my wife is all that hardy or strong, but I'll take that back just in case she's willing next time we're at the airport, you know, stick the suitcase on her head. And we made our way to the village, and along the way, we had three different river crossings. At the first river crossing, which was, it was the equivalent of all this runoff from the fields where all the animals and cattle were. And so it was kind of like a sewage water thing, and we had to hike up our pants and take off our shoes, and quite disgusting. You wade through that. At the second river crossing, they had canoes strung together that the kids would hold, and you're supposed to balance and walk across these canoes, which weren't really canoes. They were huge trees that were hollowed out, and they pretended like they were real boats. And then at the third one, the river crossing there was essentially like crossing the Missouri River. It was that far across. And again, they had one of these things, and they would jam all these Africans and one white dude, that's me, and they would jam us in there and paddle it with a shovel to get across the river. I didn't see any hippos or crocodiles, but in my mind, they were ready to attack until they sensed my presence. That's what I told myself. But what was funny about the van, imagine a minivan here in the U.S., and how many people can you put in a minivan? So this minivan had many more than eight. It had about 14 until it was time to come back. They put 18 people in there, 17 Africans and one white dude. 18 people, and I just turned around, and they're all laughing at me because they think this is normal, and I'm like, I'm taking you your picture, you weirdos, because this isn't normal. We had 18 people in this minivan, jammed it. There were people lying on the floorboards of the van on the way back for 2 hours and back into the town itself of Gambela. This next video is a picture of the church. This is Peace Lutheran Church, Gambela. This is the church we planted. This is the roof that we put on. This is the solar panel on top of that roof that we paid for so they could power their keyboard and so they could have a couple light bulbs in there when they worshiped at night. And they often worship every single day there. They give praise to God. They name their church after you guys. And this is the place where the bulk of our mission was supposed to be. I'm getting ready to preach, and I'm about to walk in, and I decided to film a little bit as they were doing pre-worship for hours before we showed up. Here's the video.
All right, we are at Peace Lutheran Church, and we're here in the village, Jaku in Gambela, and we're about to enter into worship. Kids, can you wave? Yeah? And we're getting closer to the worship.
Now, I wanted to worship with them, but I don't speak newer, or and I have no idea what they were saying, except for maybe a couple words. I did clap along to a lot of the worship, and when it came time for me to preach, Wee Ching just translated, you know, phrase for phrase and everything. There were a couple times where Wee Ching just kept going on and on and on, and I said, wait a minute, you're not saying what I said, and he said, I know. I'm like, that's not how it's supposed to work. But apparently they had never heard of Caesar or Rome, you know, and so when you're preaching about Paul and his conversion or about what Paul did, there was some expansion. The idea of an all-encompassing power, a nation, an empire that controls the world with one person, an emperor controlling the world, that concept is a concept they couldn't possibly understood. They've never had electricity there ever until we gave them a solar panel. So you can just imagine what this was like for them to meet me. A lot of the kids even would run away from me because they had just never seen anybody that looked like me of such whitishness. This last picture video is a video of some of the huts in the village. These are, you're going to see two of the three huts or homes that Wee Ching's brother James lives in. So this is what they really look like. It's a short one. He's got doors on his. That means he's pretty well off there in the village. And you see that nice awning on the front? That would be a very nice one. Dirt floors, everything. Now I asked Wee Ching, why does his brother have three different houses there? Why three different huts? And he said, well, this one over here is for his older kids, and this one is where one of his wives lives, and this one over here is where the other wife lives. And I said, homie, say what? Like, what'd you just say? And he said, yeah, his older wife lives over here, and his newer wife lives here. And so I'm like, it's full-blown polygamy time. And I said, explain to me what's going on. Because I have a Bible passage coming up here that's about polygamy, and we're going to be talking about it. And he said, well, here's the deal. When my father died, his wife at the time was passed to my brother, who was 12 years old. And now, it wasn't what we think of as a wife or anything like that, but his brother was responsible to marry her and to take care of all the children and to provide for all of them when he was 12 years old. And so he took her in, and now, later on, this woman, she went blind, and she told him, it's time for me to find a wife for you to take care of the children and to take care of the cooking and all the other things so you can continue to raise the family. And so she chose a second wife for him. And then he had a separate hut where he was living with her. And I told Wee Ching, that's really interesting. You're an LCMS pastor. You're not allowed to have more than one wife. And he agreed to that. He said, I know. But he said, in this culture, the way we think about marriage, and it's just quite different. And I said, is your brother a Christian? And he said, absolutely, he's a Christian. But it's just such different ways of understanding things. In our text for today with Jacob and Rachel and Leah, we're going to talk about polygamy, and the Bible talks a lot about polygamy, but I want to say something very, very clear. Just because the Bible describes something doesn't mean it ever endorses something. And very, very clear from the beginning of the Bible, it's clear that man and woman were made for each other, and the two become one. It doesn't say the three become one or the four become one or anything like that. The Bible never endorses polygamy. And if you hear people say that, I need you to correct them, because it's not true. But yet we have stories that describe it, and they describe how families are, and that's really quite differently. When God created you, he created you to be one with each other. And so in our story today, it's the story of Jacob, and Jacob comes along a well, and he sees the most beautiful girl in the world. It's Rachel. And there at the well, when she's, of course, coming, and she's going to feed flocks, and Jacob's just, you know, trying to find his way. At a well like this, there would be a cover over it, a big stone wheel-looking thing. And it was a kind of cover that could only be removed normally by four or maybe six men. And the shepherds, they would come, and they'd gather their flocks together, and they would push the stone off, and then they would water their flocks. But Rachel was so cute that Jacob decided he wanted to muscle up. And so all his male machismo stuff got in, and he somehow pushed the stone off, and Rachel was smitten. They fell in love. And she takes him back to her father, Laban, and expresses this love. And so finally, Laban agrees that his daughter, Rachel, is going to marry Jacob. Except on their wedding night, when Jacob goes in the tent and sleeps with his wife and wakes up in the morning, he finds out it's not Rachel, it's the older sister instead. Now here's first off, there's some cultural things that are going on here because we live in a world where sexual purity has just been thrown out the window. But in almost all old cultures, to share the marital bed was the consummation of marriage. You didn't go in front of a priest and have a priest say, I now pronounce you. Or you didn't go in front of a judge who said, I now pronounce you. And then, you know, on behalf of the state of Texas, you're married. That's not how it worked. Once you went into the marital chamber and his attendants would be waiting outside, kind of listening into the tent. Or at least that's what I've been told they did culturally. They would listen into the tent. And then these groomsmen would go out, announce to the party, I think something happened, and they're married now. And everybody would celebrate, and that celebration would go on for an entire week. And so the actual consummation of marriage is what happened there in the tent. What's happened in our culture is all of that's gotten confused. We've done everything out of order. And as you do everything out of order, there's lots of complications. There's a lot of complication of suddenly this idea of two becoming one isn't what makes you married. Or sometimes having children, that's not what makes you married. And here in this early, early culture, it's very clear. When Jacob is lying there and wakes up in the morning and it's Leah, that's his wife. It doesn't matter that he was duped. That's his wife. And now he's got to deal with it. And he goes back to Laban and he says, you're a sleaze. You did this to me. You tricked me. And Laban decides, okay, let's let this week-long party go by, and then I'll let you marry my other daughter as well. So now Jacob's got two daughters, and of course, as you can imagine, there's a lot of jealousy between the sisters. For example, in chapter 29, Leah finally is able to have a son. And this first son, and that's the son we're talking about today because we're talking about the 12 tribes, the first son is Reuben. Now Jacob, he names him Reuben because Jacob's understanding is, in Hebrew, the name Ben is the word for son. So Reuben is, this is the son of my strength. This is like Jacob's proving ground that he's able to have a family and he's able to have children. But Leah sees it quite a bit differently. She has her son Reuben, and to her, this is God's sign that he's looking on her misery and that God gives her a son and not her sister. And so this jealousy comes up. This is Leah's proving ground that maybe if Jacob looks at me and he sees that I'm able to have children with him, maybe he'll start to love me. Maybe he won't ignore me. And so she has this son, and Reuben is born. And there's a story later on where Reuben is out, and he gathers a lot of mandrakes, which is a type of plant, and takes these mandrakes to his mom. And when Rachel finds out, she comes to her sister and says, I need these mandrakes. Now, why do you need them? It's because they're supposed to be an aphrodisiac. They're supposed to be like a little blue pill. They're supposed to help you have children. And Rachel asks her sister for the mandrakes and says, instead of me getting this evening with our husband, you can have this evening with our husband. And it's a strange and it's a confusing story, but maybe the only place you've ever heard of mandrakes before is in the Harry Potter movies. Who here has seen the Harry Potter movies? Okay, there's about 12 cool people in the room. Okay, good for you. Well, in the Harry Potter movie, they explain a little bit about why these plants are so mysterious and why people wanted them. Why don't you watch a short clip from this?
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Professor.
Welcome to Greenhouse 3 Second Years. Now gather around, everyone. Today, we're going to repot mandrakes. Who here can tell me the properties of the mandrake root? Yes, Miss Granger.
Mandrake, or mandragora, is used to return those who've been petrified to their original state. It's also quite dangerous. The mandrake's cry is fatal to anyone who hears it.
Excellent. 10 points to Gryffindor. Now, as our mandrakes are still only seedlings, their cries won't kill you yet, but they could knock you out for several hours, which is why I've given each of you a pair of earmuffs for auditory protection. So can you please put them on right away? Quickly. Flaps tight down and watch me closely. You grasp your mandrake firmly. You pull it sharply out of the pot. Got it? And now you dunk it down into the other pot and pour a little sprinkling of soil to keep it warm.
Now, why is this all important? Well, here in Harry Potter, what they're trying to explain is in some folklore, mandrakes, they thought, could take something, somebody who was sick or somebody maybe who was about to die and could reanimate them, bring them back to life, which is what they're talking about here. In Jewish understanding, and you see this a lot in a lot of Jewish literature, they believe mandrakes were a natural thing that could help you become fertile, help you be able to have children. Now, Reuben, when he finds these mandrakes, what's interesting is you see this in across all the art, all the symbols on the flag of Reuben, the tribe of Reuben. You're going to see over and over again that the mandrake is the symbol of the tribe of Reuben. The other symbol of the tribe of Reuben is a wave. And Jacob makes a promise. It's a blessing of sorts, but it's also a prediction of what's going to happen to him. He says that Reuben is his firstborn. He's his might, the first sign of his strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. But he's also turbulent as waters. That's why the symbol of the wave. He's turbulent, and you'll no longer excel, for you went up onto your father's bed, onto my couch, and you defiled it. What's going on here? This is how Reuben lost his blessing. Reuben was somebody who was supposed to be the firstborn. He's supposed to get the inheritance that goes with being the firstborn. But he made a critical mistake. Jacob not only had Rachel and he had Leah as his two wives, but each of them was given a maidservant. And at a time when the two of them were competing with each other to see who could have the most kids and who could get the most favor from Jacob, they asked their husband to sleep with their maidservant. So instead of two wives, suddenly Jacob's got four of them, and they're competing with who can have the most children by all these different women. It's all complicated. And at some point, Reuben, who is so loyal to his mother, Leah, he doesn't sleep with her maidservant. Instead, he goes into his father's bedchamber and sleeps with the other maidservant, the maidservant of his aunt, Rachel. And Jacob comes to him and he says, I can't. You have just done something that's so impure and so heinous. And I can't give you the inheritance. Not only that, he can't give the inheritance to Simeon or Levi either, because these guys are such warmongers. They kept going out and causing wars and causing problems for the family. And finally, the firstborn inheritance, it skips over Reuben and then Simeon and then Levi, and it finally lands on Judah. And Jacob makes a determination here. He decides to split the inheritance. He finally says to Judah, Judah, you get to be the head of the household part. You get that part of the blessing of the firstborn. And then he goes to Rachel's oldest son, that's Joseph, and he says, you get the other half of the blessing of the firstborn. You get the double inheritance. And that's why if you ever go and you look at the tribes of Israel, and since we're talking about the 12 tribes, this is going to be important because you're going to look at a map and you're going to say some things are missing. First off, where is Levi here? I don't see a tribe of Levi anywhere. Well, the Levites, they were the priests. And so the Levites, they put some of them in each of the tribes all around Israel. They were supposed to care for the people. They were the priests of the people. And so the double inheritance was supposed to go to Reuben, but now it's gone to Joseph. And so if you look at the tribes, you'll notice there's no tribe of Joseph there in the land. There's his sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And so as you look through the 12 tribes, you're going to see how this is. And the problem with Reuben is he wasn't all bad. I mean, there were mistakes he made early on, and God works that way in all of our lives where we're going to make sin. We're going to have sins in our lives. We're going to make mistakes in our lives, but God can redeem us. Far later on, it seems like Reuben learns from his mistakes. His brothers have taken Joseph, and they've decided they wanted to kill him. You remember Joseph? He's the guy with the multicolored coat. He's the guy that's always bragging to his brothers that dad loves me best and one day you guys are all going to bow down before me. And his brothers are ready to kill him. It's Reuben that steps up and it's Reuben who says, this is wrong, this is evil, let's not do this. His brothers instead throw him in a pit. Reuben comes back later and he's trying to find his brother. He's trying to rescue Joseph. But the brothers have now sold him into slavery. Now, Joseph ends up in Egypt, and he ends up in the household of Pharaoh, and he ends up powerful, and all that works out. But it's even later on that when the brothers are trying to get out of issues that they have with Egypt, it's Reuben who goes to his father and promises Jacob that we can get over there, and we're going to be safe, and I'm going to care for our youngest brother, Benjamin. Reuben's the one that continues to step up. And maybe that's the lesson in here for all of us. We all have some complications in our families. We all have things that are going wrong. But what's God going to do with you when you're at that point and you can't go back in time and change anything? What's God going to do with you now? And maybe that lesson is found in our gospel lesson today. The gospel lesson is the parable of the growing seed. And in the parable of the growing seed, it says that the kingdom of God is like a seed and it sprouts and it grows. And the farmer, he doesn't even know it. The farmer doesn't control the sun. The farmer can't control the rain. The seed is doing things and he can't even control it. And sometimes in our lives, there's things that we've done, there's mistakes that we've done, but God still wants to work with us and still wants to grow us. But Jesus makes clear at the end of the parable that God is waiting. He's waiting for all of us to ripen. And then the harvest is going to come. And some of that happens for Reuben. And so maybe a lesson for all of us today. Who here in the room is a father or a grandfather or a great-grandfather? Could you raise your hand? Are there any great-grandfathers? Could you raise your hand? Any great-grandfathers? Yeah, that doesn't seem possible. You're so young and handsome. All right, fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, y'all stand. Please stand. Give them a hand, please. Yeah. Despite all of his mistakes, God continues to say, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, despite all of his mistakes, God continues to work through this family. And then later on with the tribe, God continues to work through their families. And one of the things that we need to know is we could call upon Jesus and we can say, Jesus, we know that you're our Lord and you're our Savior, that you've given us the gift of forgiveness of sins. You could take care of those things. And now you're giving us the gift of eternal life. But Jesus turns back and says, yeah, but there's still a growing seed in your life right now. Right now I want to do something with you. Right now I want to do something with your family. Right now there's more that I can change about you. Let me invite you all to stand. We're going to have a prayer now over our fathers as well as all the different people in our church who need our prayer requests and as we set the Lord's table today.